Hello, welcome to Prime Lenses. I'm Ian. Each week I speak with a guest about three lenses that have meant something to them on their photographic journey. And this week, my guest is Nick Rains. One of the great perks of making a show like this is getting to sit down for a while with someone whose work you've enjoyed already for a number of years. Nick's had a long career that's seen his photographic horizon shift from small terraced houses in Manchester to broad landscapes in countries all over the world. I came across him via his videos on YouTube, and his calm, methodical approach has introduced me and millions of others to many a camera feature or maintenance technique. My clean sensor thanks you, Nick. He was a treat to chat to, and I think you'll really enjoy his lens selection as well. So please enjoy this conversation with Nick. Scotland on a sunny day is very hard to beat. Really nice. Have you ever been?
Well, it was. I've been as far as the Isle of Bute.
Oh, okay.
As far north as I've been. Apart from that, not been at all.
Yeah. How's it over with you today?
Oh, 24 degrees, blue sky. Yeah, that's winter.
It's funny, we're planning a trip to Australia, so like we're coming over for the first time. I've been to New Zealand before, I've never been to Australia, and I was talking to, shout out to Tom, super fan of the show, who lives in Sydney, and was saying, you know, we're looking forward to coming over in July, and I'll take the boys out and we'll run around and maybe, you know, go in the sea. And he was like, but it's July. And I was like, yeah, but I live in Scotland, so for me 15 to 20 degrees is perfect. It's amazing weather, you know, like it's whereas to an Aussie, I feel like you're feeling let down at that point. Like,
well, I'm an ex-Englishman anyway, so it all feels good.
Yeah, well, I was wondering about that because I've watched your videos for years, and I wondered whether I was detecting a little bit of an accent in the videos.
I've been here 35 years now, so pretty much. Well, I'm an Australian resident, so I get back probably once or twice a year. So that's handy. Wow. My work with Leica takes me back to Germany quite regularly, so it's easy enough to pop over to see the folks in Manchester. So I tend to do that. So I'm quite lucky, really.
Yeah. Oh, that's brilliant. What took you to Australia in the first case, then?
Just work and opportunities, photographic opportunities. So it seemed like a good idea at the time.
The best things do. I moved to Scotland for love. Like, this is what you do. You just end up, you end up in the place you end up. Your past, it was interesting, doing a bit of research and a bit of prep for the episode. Your background, it seems like you started off like in sciences and life science and stuff like that, maybe, and then fairly early on found photography. Was it photography discovered through life science and zoology type stuff, and you were like, actually, this is the part of it I'm enjoying? Or was it something you'd always enjoyed, and then you've got something in your back pocket?
A little bit of both. When I was at university, I was studying zoology, and I was also, I'm not quite sure how it came about, but I got somehow interested in buying a camera. I think I was seduced by somebody's Pelican case with all the cutouts and a little lens in each pocket, and it looked like very cool. And I think I talked my way into a Christmas present of an Olympus OM-10. I think that was my first of the serious 35mm, you know, SLR cameras. But it also gave me, at university, I used to photograph the concerts. So for the Student Union magazine. So it was a good way of getting sort of backstage in the concerts. They had a dark room, you'd process the film, you'd load your own film, process the film and do some prints. And then that would end up in the Student Union magazine. So that was just for fun. I really can't quite remember how that exactly came about, but something like that. It was something that piqued my interest. And then once I left university with a modest level degree in a very modestly vocational subject, as in not very much, my father was a partner in quite a large real estate company, and they outsourced all of their photography for the pictures in the windows. And I seem to remember having a conversation with him when he was moaning about how much it cost. So I said, well, how much does it cost? And he told me how much it cost. And I said, oh, poof, that's ridiculous. I could do it for less than that. And he said, well, you haven't got a job, so why don't you? So I did. And for about 2 years, I ended up photographing a large number of drab little terraces in Manchester, which was not quite the glamorous photography lifestyle I might have looked for, but it was certainly a start. And I also did I don't know if you are familiar with the City and Guilds sort of TAFE, we'd call it TAFE in Australia, but the City and I did a City and Guilds thing in studio assistants. That was 2 years, one day a week, to get some sort of, you know, experience, I suppose. And that's how I really got into professional photography, because I was earning a living directly through photography. So I is one.
I love that. Yeah. I think it happens more often than we realize, is that before you know it, you've built up a portfolio of work, you know?
Yeah, I think, and again, I don't want to do the when I was a lad kind of thing, but when I was a lad, it was on one hand a lot harder to produce quality work. But on the other hand, a lot easier, because there was more of a market for quality work. Mm. Now it's a lot easier to produce quality work technically, but it's a lot harder to find a market for it. So it's kind of flipped around. So my experiences in the 80s don't really have any bearing on, as a starting photographer, if anyone's listening and thinking about that side of things, that doesn't really have any relevance to modern days. I think I would really not like to be starting out these days. You'd have to have a very different mindset.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. We're going through the process of selling I've written about it on the newsletter and stuff, but my grandmother's had to move out of her house. And so we're in the process of sorting her house and selling it. And when we talked to various estate agents to kind of work out who you're going to work with to sell a house, one of the selling points of the ones we went with was we have a photographer, we take proper photos. As opposed to we've given someone an iPhone with a wide angle do that, because they still saw the value in producing a proper printed asset. I mean, it's also a type of house, you know, the type of house an old lady has lived in for a long time is also the type of house that someone who's got some means and is still of a generation probably who appreciates seeing a real photograph and wants to hold a pamphlet in their hands and look at a thing and kind of like have that tactility, maybe rather than they're just straight onto the internet and looking at stuff.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're doing, in the experience that we're having right now, we're doing both.
Yeah.
We've got, there's, you know, the big aggregator websites, of course, but we've also having one of their premium brochures done, and it feels really nice. And I agree, because for me, a print is a photograph, not on the screen. That's an intermediate step. So on the walls around me are photographs. That's the end point, not the sort of they call it consuming, I think, these days on devices, all of which I have and all of which I do. But at the end of the day, the reason I've got that dirty great big printer behind me is because Leica supports that side of the industry by having exhibitions regularly in Sydney and Melbourne of large, high quality prints by well-known photographers. So it's that's kind of fun.
It does make a huge difference. It is really worth, like, to people listening who maybe don't, it's easy to not to realize that it's been years since you went and looked at something on a wall, but it's a really great thing to do, to go and experience something with other people, and or at least in a space, you know, where you can go, even if it is just going, I joke when I go to London, like if I'm in town, I'll try and go to Church, which is the Leica store, because they've got that little gallery space, and it's only small, but it's nice to be able to go into it.
Yeah, I know the space.
And it's just nice to go and see people. There's some natural light. There's some people going back and forth outside. It just has a different feel to just looking at something. Even if you just, you know, LFI, the app for LFI is really good. You can look at the entire back catalogue of that magazine that's run for decades and find, you know, have instantaneous access to incredible photography and some good writing around it and all the rest of it. But it isn't the same as holding the thing. It, you know, it's just got a different, I don't know whether it's a different part of your brain or what it is, but it feels better.
I think one of the things about the printed image, whether it's offset printed in a magazine or whether it's printed for the wall like these, there's a certain technical hurdle you have to overcome, certainly in offset printing. So there's a kind of gatekeeping aspect to it. So anything that's displayed, like books are a great example. A book requires a considerable investment, a proper book that's been published, you know, quite a few thousand copies by a publisher. There's you know, tens of thousands of dollars of investment by somebody in that thing that you hold in your hand, or for printing that's on the wall. So there's a qualification of the work implicit in that, as opposed to lobbing a portfolio on the internet, which anybody can do. That's not to say the work's not good, or it has nothing to say about the work, but most of the work that you're going to see in a book and most of the work that you're going to see in a gallery has broadly been considered by other people in the industry to be worthy. Therefore, look at it and learn, if you like, as opposed to all the stuff that you're exposed to through social media, et cetera. So that I tend to follow that approach, and I really enjoy books as well. I've got quite a large collection of photo books. And if you want, I also say to my students when I'm doing my workshops, or when I used to do workshops, was that if you really want to improve your photography, buy a printer, because there's nowhere to hide when you're making A2, minimum A2 or bigger. Anything less than that's dead easy, but A2 prints, there's nowhere to hide technically. If that looks good, then your technique is spot on, but there's no escaping bad focus, bad light, bad anything. And that's how you should learn. There's your end point.
Yeah. No, we do get away with murder on these tiny screens. You know, they the high DPI does convince you.
2,048 pixels wide. I mean, crikey. My camera shoots at almost 10,000 pixels wide, so I have to reduce the resolution by a factor of 16 to get that. It's ludicrous.
By which time? At which time as well? Because I remember I used to find this scanning printed stuff, like when I used to do web type stuff in the 90s, and so you would end up a lot of the time taking print materials and scanning those. To bring them in. But you also, what I used to notice was, I'm going to sound like a very old man, but like when the maximum screen resolution was 1024x768, which is actually at the time on a CRT seemed really high res and like really good, but actually nowadays is, you know, a postage stamp. When you take something scanned, even if the quality of the scanned, the material you were scanning from wasn't very good, if you then shrunk that down to some sort of resolution and you were making separate thumbnail images to click on to then make a bigger image, you got a lot of natural sharpening or kind of cleaning up of the image just by virtue of resizing the thing. Whereas nowadays, like if I'm running around the forest near my house and I like to shoot a lot of F8 and, you know, I have an M11, so I'm usually at like 36 in the middle because I don't need to, you know, this isn't for work. And, you know, the world doesn't need all these photos of trees that I'm making. It's fine. But I'm finding shooting at higher resolutions and shooting at high apertures that, like, I see all the stuff, like, I should have remembered to clean the lens. I should have remembered. Like,
it's not very forgiving.
No, you don't get away with anything now on modern stuff. So actually, you know, in some ways, we didn't know how good we had it when we were sort of, when I was monkeying around with stuff, when I was learning. But it's probably good, because if I'd encountered all of this, all of these little things are like micro friction in the process, I might have given up sooner if I'd felt like I wasn't doing as well, you know?
Yeah, it's a fair point. I've just printed, if it's just going live next week, I've got to launch the exhibition on Thursday in Sydney and Friday in Melbourne. We've got, it's the 50th anniversary of the end of the Vietnam War this year, which you probably know. And one of my friends from the past, who passed away a couple of years ago, is a gentleman called Tim Page, who was one of the classic Vietnam War photographers. I don't know if you've come across his work. He was also featured in a couple of documentaries, and he was the inspiration behind the Dennis Hopper character in Apocalypse Now. So he was a bit of a mover and a shaker. Anyway, we've just done an exhibition of his work, which I've just printed. So it's all 35mm Tri-X, probably, shot on his M3, which we've still got in the exhibition. And I've scanned on Crossfield, drum scanner, and I've just been making those prints up to AO. And yeah, they're grainy as hell, but my God, they look good.
Yeah.
They really, really look, they're very, very organic. So the exhibition looks superb. I've just seen some pictures just only about 2 hours ago of the actual hang that's been done. I'll see it in the flesh on Thursday. And that's sort of all from Leica glass top film. I think it was Tri-X he used to use. I should know that. But even at that limited resolution of, I don't know what you'd say in digital terms, 8 to 10 megapixels maybe, it still enlarges beautifully, and it has a real organic look to it. And it's about the witnessing, not who really cares how many megapixels there are when you're photographing the sort of stuff that people like that are photographing. So
Well, I think that's one of the powerful things about this, these conversations, and I say it often during the episodes, this is kind of like a reminder, is that it's we can convince ourselves that everything has to be perfect, that everything has to be absolutely just right, and actually the photography, the first job of a photo is to tell a story and ideally move you in some way. Either, you know, like to kind of do something, you want a reaction, like with all art, I think you want a reaction from the person experiencing it, whether they're looking at it, listening to it or whatever. And so the thing that has struck me in the last couple of years as I've started to have these conversations and talk to more creative people is that it being pin, tack, sharp, perfectly action, perfectly frozen or whatever is much less important than we think. And I had Torsten Overgaard on last year, and he was talking about, you know, pixel peeping. It might be entertaining, was the, I think the word he used, which I really liked. It's like, it might entertain you in the moment, but it's not necessarily making the picture better or making you better or whatever. You know, if you, did you get the moment or not is much more important.
Yeah, well, there's a great Ansel Adams quote, which you probably come across about that. Do you know the one?
I'm not sure.
There's nothing worse than a sharp photograph of a fuzzy concept.
Oh, I like that. No, I don't know that.
Really good. Yeah. So, which is exactly the same thing. I think that was it? Hang on a sec. Now, that might be Edward Weston talking about Ansel Adams.
Right.
One of the two of them, because Edward Weston was far more freeform in his photography, and Ansel Adams was F64 Club, all about sharpness. It might, I may have got that wrong. I'm sure somebody will correct me on that one. But it's a good quote, and it was one of those two guys. I could be Edward Weston. I know Edward Weston said that anything more than 500 yards, I think, from the car is not photogenic by definition. Because he didn't want to go lugging large format cameras up mountains like Ansel Adams used to do. So between the two, they've got plenty of good quotes to trot out at suitable moments.
Yes. Yeah, I need to maybe fill up the quote bank, because I noticed, like, doing this every week and talking to people every week, sometimes I tell the same stories over and again, which no one seems to mind, but I'm conscious of it. I'm telling, you know, I'm bored of my own stories myself. But no, I'll look that one up afterwards. Yeah, that's really good.
But yes, well, you're quite right. I mean, we had a Robert Capa, we had a Henri Cartier-Bresson exhibition here in Brisbane a few years ago now, 10 plus years. And my wife was astonished how many of them are completely out of focus and commented on that. And then we realized that it's the mood totally.
Same with some of the Elliot Erwitt ones from last year.
Absolutely.
When the dog shots, you know, the really kind of opportunistic ones.
Well, interesting enough, I'll be very, having gone from Tim Page's shot under literally, you know, gunfire situations in Vietnam, the next exhibition that I'll be printing very soon will be Steve McCurry.
Right.
So that'll be very interesting to see how the original scans of his work look from the Kodachrome days compared to the Tri-X stuff processed in some, you know, in the back closet of his hotel room or whatever. That'll be a very interesting juxtaposition, I think. Quite an honor, actually, to do both of them.
I was going to say, because the nice thing, I mean, I brand myself a tourist in photography, right? I'm not, I'm unburdened by this being my job and being my work. I get to enjoy photography and image making with the people that make them, but I don't have to worry necessarily about my making. But for you, as someone who regularly curates and pulls together other people's images and experiences a whole career, that must be quite a rare privilege to get to kind of sit down and run through them like that.
Yeah, it's a bit of a team effort. Yeah. We have a gallery manager as well. In theory, I'm just the printer. In reality, from a generational point of view, I'm considerably more senior to the rest of the staff in the office. So I do put my oar in occasionally with my opinion, which, to be fair, to all credit to them, they don't just, you know, yeah, okay, boomer, you know, this sort of stuff. They do take me seriously. Because I do know what I'm talking about. but it is quite a privilege. Most of the people we've had up to this point, I've either known quite well, or I think, the last bunch. I did a lot of Phil Penman's prints when we had him as an exhibition here. I did all of his prints here, which he was very happy with, luckily for me. And that they were, well, if he's listening, they were so easy to print because they were just perfectly prepared. Sometimes I have to do a little bit of jiggery-pokery and a bit of wizardry, but the people I've mostly worked with have got a very good understanding of what's required, and I get really good material sent to me. So the Tim Page stuff was, I hadn't printed black and white film 35mm film scans before, so that was interesting. And then Steve McCurry, I don't know him personally. We just all know the work basically. But it is a privilege because you do get to see a different aspect of their work, because a lot of them want you to show something that is not so commonly seen. Some people will shoot specifically for an exhibition. It depends. I mean, we have 4 per year per gallery, but they're repeated in each gallery, so it's 4 artists per year are featured. And we've had some quite big names. Alan
Schaller.
Yeah, he was terrific. Seriously, he's so committed. He's an ex-musician. So this is an interesting analogy, let's say, in photography. He started off as a musician and was a commercial musician that he wrote advertising jingles.
Right.
It's a living. He's got to write music. He's got to know music inside and out. But for some reason, he moved from that into photography. But he brought a musician's approach to the work because he used to practice, which I don't know. I don't practice. I just go out and take pictures. But he would sit there in his living room with his monochrome, it was the original monochrome he had, with whatever lens he had, and he would guess distances and shoot a frame, just whatever, randomly. So whilst he's watching TV, he'd just go, oh, that's about 85 inches. Click.
Yeah.
And check it. And he would do this. And over a long period of time, he developed the ability to pretty much nail it every single time. Now, the only way you can do that is by practicing a lot. And now he gets the most astonishing pictures of literally seat-of-the-pants stuff because he can do that.
Yeah.
There's only one other guy I know I've seen do that, and that's a gentleman in Sydney who's a wedding photographer, John Lahan, and he's one of our Leica friends, let's say. And his party trick is nailing focus on a Noctilux on an M camera by guessing. And that's his party trick. And he's got a whole look based around shooting on the Nocti, which, for those who don't know, it's a 50mm 0.95 f0.95 lens, so has no depth of field and very hard to lens to focus. And he just does it by guessing the distance. That is years of practice.
Yeah.
Not necessarily relevant to everybody.
No.
Like, I also have autofocus cameras, which make life a lot easier. But that's not the point, young man.
No, exactly.
But when Alan told me this, and he had a huge following on social media, this is when Instagram was far more relevant possibly for photographers than it is now. But he would spend about 2 hours a day interacting and posting on Instagram, so that he built up this 300,000 or 400,000 followers, and that's how he sells his prints and makes his living. So he took it incredibly seriously, like a professional musician would do for their music. And I was very impressed by his approach, because it's actually very easy to get away with being a bit lazy, let's say.
Yes.
Guilty as charged here.
Yeah, there is a, I mean, I've mentioned this before, but it's the old adage, if you've got good people around you, they say this to you periodically. I'm guilty of saying that I'm lucky sometimes. And a friend of mine called me out on it recently and was like, well, the more you practice, the luckier you seem to get.
That's a quote from, I think, a golfer, Jack Nicklaus, one of those guys. Yeah, Gary Player.
Right, there we go.
Amazing how the more I practice, the luckier I get. It's very true.
Yeah, so I think there's a good one there. That's a party trick I'd quite like to develop. I don't have I'll get my 50 F2 out later and
it's just as difficult. You've gone from half a centimeter depth of field to 1 centimeter depth of field.
Yeah.
Still pretty challenging.
Yeah, oh yeah. Especially, but you know, if it means I can get that red squirrel, then when he's in the garden, then, you know, I'll give that a try. Well, that might be a nice segue in some ways onto what you sent me a list of 3 lenses. They're as varied, I think, as you're kind of like...
You weren't expecting that, were you?
No, it's great. I love it because it's so broad. You've gone from really long zooms, all primes as well, I think, but really long zoom, like, or telephoto, all the way to the widest I think anyone has ever chosen. And I was hoping to start with the wide one because from the street... Well,
they were kind of in chronological order. I don't know if that's relevant.
Well, either or, but...
Okay.
Pick your favorite.
I'll go
choice.
With the first one because I chose them because they were so significant at different parts of my career.
Okay.
So yes, the first lens that I chose was one of the, not the original, because if anybody knows the history of Canon SLRs, there was a twist lock or breech lock mount lens, and I forget the designation, but the next ones were the normal bayonet mounting, which were the FD lenses. And that's where I started seriously with the Canon F1N and various bits and bobs. And at some point I invested in the 135 F2, which I did a lot of very early travel photography with. And that was where I discovered, not necessarily by knowing I was going to get it, but the out of focus background effect, which is incredibly useful for travel portraiture. So, and it was had a very distinctive look, that lens. And it was only, I don't know, 4 inches long, quite compact, fat and heavy, but compact. And I adored that lens. It was my go-to lens for pretty much any portrait I took when I was traveling through. I did a lot of traveling through Europe in the late 80s. And I really enjoyed that one so much that when I switched over to the EF mount autofocus lenses, I also bought the subsequent 135 F2 EF mount lens, which I also used a lot. But it was that particular one that I thought was where I was started to get a polished look that had a little bit of style to it, even though it's considered to be fairly mundane these days. But back in those days, that was a pretty exotic lens, and it wasn't cheap. I remember I had to save up for that and think, do I really need this? Because there's also a 135 2.8, which was much cheaper, but I wanted the F2. So that was my first exotic lens that I ever owned, and had a big effect on my style, I think.
Yeah, well, Phil Penman was on recently and was talking about the lens he uses for a particular look, the 75 that he's got.
The 75 Nocti.
Which, you know, a different league in terms of expensive lens, but he's using it for a look, right? There is a brush that he wants in his bag to be able to paint with, effectively.
That's
and
it.
I think that's the thing, is that when you can't fake that. We've seen it with phone camera things with like portrait effects that they are.
Yeah, it's fakery. That's right. That's speaking of that particular lens. I was very fortunate to have an early prototype of that to test. So I shot a lot of the proof of performance pictures with that for Leica in Germany. Yeah. So I went to a lot of Australian festivals with it and shot a lot of rodeos with it. And just country fairs and so on. And I thought it was astonishing. Quite different to the Nocti 50mm. The Nocti 50 is more like a mad scientist with the hair, and the 75 Nocti is more like the clinical German BMW technician. Everything is perfect and alles in Ordnung, as they would say. Yeah. Very, very clinical, very clean. Completely different, but both very, very interesting. And yeah, I really would like one of those 75s myself, but they are terribly expensive, as you say. And the Minister of War and Finance, namely my wife, wants a business case for that, and I can't quite supply a sufficient one yet.
I mean, you've printed Phil's images, right? Like that's his business case, and he's printing him, you know, books and all the rest of it. But yeah,
well, we did a display print of one of Phil's shots as New York shots off the 75, but we did 1.5 by 2.5 meters, and then we had it laminated, and we've still got it in the Sydney store so they can roll it out, and it takes up the entire sales bench, and it's absolutely astonishingly beautiful. It's a really great image, so that was a lot of fun. I love working with other photographers' images when they're really good. It's always a bit of a problem when they're not very good, but you go, what am I going to do? But someone like his stuff is just, like I said before, it's quite effortless. So yeah, so that was my first my first exotic lens. The second one, which I think was when I realized that I had finally stepped into the bigger medium league, not quite big league, but medium league, was back in 1986 and 87. There was a repeat of the America's Cup yachting in Fremantle, because in 1983 the Australians won it back from the Americans for the first time in over 100 years. So it's a big deal. Dennis Connor, Alan Bond, all those people. It moved to Fremantle, and this is quite by coincidence. This is one of those career, what would you say, serendipitous events that you go, there's before and there was after. Right. I came to Australia after photographing my dingy little terraces in northern Manchester for quite a few years looking for adventure. And I landed in Fremantle pretty much at that time and managed to bullshit my way into the media centre. I mean, I was a real photographer, but I had no magazine affiliation or anything. I was strictly freelance, and they were very open to freelancers, so I had no problems. I mean, it was only a little bit of bullshit. I just had to ask, and they said, yeah, here, have a press pass, which was great. So the thing is, though, the Time magazine guys were there. I got friendly with them. Sports Illustrated guys were there. I got friendly with them. The Associated Press News guys were there. I got friendly with them. The Reuters guy, everybody, the entire world's press were there. And I also picked up a job working for Canon directly, because at these big events, you know, they have these loan services where they'll give you lots of big lenses just as part of the, as a CPS member. Well, I ran that as a job, but I also had time to do my own photographs. So I was able to dip into whatever was left at the end of the day. And the 300 2.8 turned out to be the perfect lens. That or the 500 depends for yachting photography. Right. But I couldn't afford one because they were very, very expensive, very exotic. And I lusted after one of these things. Anyway, having worked with them, I did a lot of work on a sort of, well, we'll just do it under the table a little bit. We won't pay you exactly, but if you want something, we'll kind of work out a deal. Yeah. So I said, right, I want that, and that. F1N, motor drives, and the 300 2.8. So I worked off my sort of indentured worker, I was, I suppose. Anyway, I worked that off, and at the end of it, there you go. There's this big, beautiful box in the case, and then my 300 2.8, and I used that lens a lot.
Yeah.
It was my go-to lens for a long time, and that was when I figured that it was that was a serious lens for us, you know, serious bit of investment and a serious bit of kit. It did get upgraded to a 400 2.8 at one point, which was even more ridiculously exotic, but that was too heavy. That got stolen very conveniently, because that was at the time they finished the FD range and bought out the EF range. And on the insurance money, I bought myself the 300 2.8 image stabilized, which was on my list. And that, again, I only got rid of that recently because it eventually broke down, and they don't keep parts anymore for one of those lenses. And I didn't use it very much because at that point I was 99% Leica shooting. So that was my last lens of my Canon stuff. And once that had gone, I got rid of everything. So that was the significance of that lens.
Oh, nice. There you go. A good one. I've used the 400, a more modern Canon 400. I went to the MotoGP a few years ago with Honda's photographer, a guy called Andrew Northcott. And he shot Canon gear, and I got to use his 400 and 800 primes, which were insane. Like, they're just massive. Oh, just wonderful. And the images you'll get of motorbikes doing nearly 200 miles an hour with a really big, fast prime. Oh, yeah. Just tremendous.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We imagine try standing on the back of a boat in rough conditions, photographing yachting. That's what we would do. And this is pre-autofocus.
Yeah.
So we're having to track focus manually,
wobbling around, swaying.
And that was tricky.
Difficult to keep your lunch down, I imagine, depending.
There were times.
Yeah.
There were times. That, unfortunately, the best photographs are when it's roughest.
Yes.
You get, and those particular style of yachts, the 12-meter class, were very nimble. And the wind off Fremantle is very predictable in the afternoon. It gets quite rough. Right. So you had lots of bang, splash, it was the best time. So again, that lens is significant because it's when I've met a lot of people who became very helpful to me in my career. So it really was the launch of my proper international career in travel and sport photography. The lens is just a symbol of that in a sense, but it was the contacts I made. I mean, there was Enrico Ferrarelli from Sports Illustrated, Daniel Forster from Time, Leo Mason was there, Franco Pace from Italy, a lot of these guys. I mean, these were like, to me, it was, Bill Epridge, he used to shoot for, he used to shoot news, and he was the guy who photographed Bobby Kennedy when he was assassinated.
Wow.
Yeah, and then that was the last time he did political photography. He'd had enough of it, then he turned to sports. He was a really impressive guy, you know. I've got a photograph of me drinking Jack Daniels in a bar with him and another very tall American guy, and I'm like 23 with a stupid little mustache, which I should never have grown, and these two big Americans pouring Jack Daniels into my glass. It's a treasured photograph now.
Oh, amazing. No, it is the people you meet along the way. It's wild. I think the life you can have if you've got a camera in your hands and you can go and travel.
Privileged access in many cases if you do. I mean, yeah. I've had some experience I could never have got, especially with, you know, getting press passes and so on and so forth. If you treat it as a privilege rather than a sort of right. I did a book on Australian festivals in 2018 and 2019. And I went to the organizers of all these festivals, and for every single one, I had some sort of press credentialing. And it was amazing how much fun that was to be able to be basic. Well, one of the big music festivals here is called the Gympie Muster, and it's a big country western festival not far from where I live. And there's the big sort of natural bowl with all the people, and then there's a stage. But I wasn't so interested in the particular act. It was the people that go to the festivals I was focusing on, really. So I wanted to photograph the people. So I just went and stood behind the drummer on the stage and just photographed out. Everyone just ignored me, you know. Oh, he's got a press pass thing, you know, and they're having smoke and lights going. And I was interested in the audience looking at us backwards. And I remember that was a lot of fun. So you can sort of hide in plain sight if you have the courage to pull it off. I shouldn't probably say this, but my secret way of hiding is to wear a high vis vest. You wear a high vis vest and no one notices you. They just think you're on official business, so ignore him.
Yeah, well, Doug Menway, I had Doug on last year, and he was talking about standing still behind the scenes is kind of a way of just is a super. He was in meetings at Adobe where they were talking about going through bills they had to pay in like board type meetings. And they would mention, oh, we've got to pay the photographer. Yeah, oh, we can do that later. And he was like, and they'd just forgotten he was there.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And no, that's true. All these things are important. They're sort of standing still. I've done that myself, photographing sort of in... There was a particular time in China, in Shanghai, they do this outdoor ballroom dancing. I don't know if you've seen pictures of that. So there's like 300 or 400 people doing ballroom dancing on the street outside in Shanghai every morning. I mean, you can go there and watch, it's just there. And to photograph that bunch of strangers, you know, you've got to be certain sensitivity to things. So I just stood by a lamppost with my camera like this and just watched, and they'd sort of ebb and flow. I'm watching for patterns. But by the time they'd done that a few times, I was invisible, and I just could just pick my shots as I needed. So a bit of patience, a little bit of that hide in plain sight makes a big difference to that sort of photography.
Related, I guess, sort of as a practice question, when you've come up with your ideas for your projects and for your books and things like that, do you Alan Schaller style practice and commit and sit down to come up with ideas, or do these things kind of flow through you and one day you go, this is the thing I should do next, I should do the festivals or I should do the ballroom or...
A little bit comes from discussions with the publisher too. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, we're trying to make money out of these products. So it's got to be a commercial basis for this. So I can't just sort of randomly pick something I fancy doing. Yeah. It has to be something that somebody somewhere thinks might be a good idea. So it's a little bit of a team effort. The festivals one, I think, was my wife's idea, which had been sort of gestating for a while because we'd photographed a lot of festivals. Well, we photographed quite a few festivals when I was shooting with that 75mm Nocti. And the pictures that I shot were really, really well received in Germany. And I really enjoyed shooting them. I was actually really quite pleased with them. And we thought, well, maybe we could expand on that. I did a commercial job a few years before for the South Australian government, where they wanted someone to go and photograph outback communities for a website. It's a political group that sort of administrates. It's like a local council, but they actually administer the whole north part of South Australia, huge area. And long story short, the guy who ran that department knew me anyway from another book many years beforehand, and he rang me up and said, did I want to go and basically spend 6 or 7 weeks photographing communities around the outback, which of course is dead interesting. So we did that and really enjoyed that too, and necessarily we went to some country shows, some rodeos, all sorts of wacky events, you know, golf in 45 degrees in the middle of the outback where they just bulldoze through the bush and then oil a patch for the green. So that's and then it raises money for the Royal Flying Doctor Service. Yes. And everyone dresses in plus fours and there's beer and all this stuff. So I photographed that. And then we had a bit of a body of work. So we went to the publisher and said, well, maybe we could expand on that. And that went down quite well. Yeah. Unfortunately, and this is often the case with these projects, it was published in March 2020. Pretty much the day all the bookshops closed. Yes. So it basically disappeared without a trace, because once a couple of years had gone past and, you know, what's the next book? And we missed that bus by a country mile, which is a shame because I'm really quite pleased with the work. But anyway, what can you do? I had fun shooting it.
Hopefully pandemics don't come along that often.
Hopefully
and,
not.
And you've still got the body of work. So I suppose there's always...
I've still got the body of work, yeah. We had a lot of fun shooting it. So it was by no means a waste of time, which allows me to segue into the third lens, which is the 18 millimeter wide angle, which was my first Leica lens that I ever bought. I had, what do I have? I'm trying to think why I was, I think I had it on an M, oh, I know, M240. That's right. I shot with the S2 system for 2 years. That was the medium format Leica. But it was a little bit heavy. So I, as soon as the M240 came out, so that's the successor to the M9, it was the first one with live view and an electronic viewfinder, which is what I wanted because rangefinders are hard to use. And so I bought the M240, and the only lens I wanted for it was the 18. I needed the EVF for it because you can't see, the viewfinder doesn't cover the 18 mil angle of view unless you put a supplementary viewfinder on top, which is a pain. So that's why I wanted the M240. And I used that lens a lot for street photography because you're right in the middle of things. I really wanted it to be, I wanted the images to be as though you were inside what was going on. I mean, if I look through Lightroom, I've got a very high percentage of images shot on that lens. You know, I've got about 250 lenses listed in Lightroom because I used to do a lot of camera reviews, so I've used ridiculous number of cameras, but still there's, you know, 30,000-40,000 pictures shot with just that one lens. I've still got it. I don't use it as much as I used to. I kind of changed my style a little bit now. But at the time, it was a beautiful, beautiful, and it was quite cheap. It was one of the more affordable lenses. But one of my privileges that I have working as a contractor for Leica is I do get to borrow things occasionally. So if I really, really want to try something out for a few weeks, if it's available in the loan pool, I can use it. So in many cases, that's meant I haven't had to actually buy something. Don't tell Mr. Leica that.
Yes, I'm sure they'll let you off the hook.
But hopefully.
But don't worry, they've got some spares if you do decide to avail yourself of one. I think Phil told us a story with the 75 where he was borrowing it off someone until it became clear that this was going to be something he was going to use. And he was like, okay, I'm going to have to do this.
Exactly.
I like the look of the 18 because it looks kind of nice and compact.
Oh, it's
and
tiny.
And optically it's amazing.
About that big.
Yeah. I
like
it.
Really, really small.
Yeah, because I've got the
Like I've used it a lot and it's lovely. It's an old design, which is why they retired it. So optically, it's only really up to 60 megapixels of your M11 if you stop down to 5.6. Shoot at 3.5.
Yeah.
Just showing its age a little bit.
Yeah.
Not super critical, but on the 240, which was, 24 megapixels, it was fine.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, no, I it's an appealing one to have for, as you say, that being in, if you're in a confined space and creatively the things that you can do. Tom Oldham was on recently, talked about lenses being ideas in a can, right? Like that one was, and I had, I'm really enjoying this phrase at the moment. It's probably not as funny as it is in my head, but having a podcast is like being a cab driver. And so I rattle off people I've had on recently. It's like that Gajan Bala was in my cab the other week, but he was talking about taking, I think, a 21 inside the cabin of a truck in India when he was there on the street because it becomes someone's, it's like it's someone's office. And so
I have done literally that with an 18. I mean, quite literally a cab on a tuk-tuk or whatever in India. My first and second trips to India, I shot a huge number of pictures with that particular lens.
Right. Yeah.
It was just suited me at the time. Like I said, I've moved on a little bit from it now, but that's because I'm not doing quite so much actual travel work of that style anymore.
Right.
I have a different path at the moment, and that's more 24 to 90 zoom style. So get it done. You know, I don't have the luxury of a particular style or look. It has to get the damn photograph for the commercial client. Yeah. Therefore, 24 to 90 gets the job done. There's a whole different ball game. An M system would be a huge indulgence. I mean, I'm on SL3S and the Zooms.
You hear that a lot from people I talk to as well. Like, there's the ones for them and the ones for me. And the 18 might be a one for you, but then how often are you shooting
well,
the one for
I've
you?
I've got an M9, which a resurrected M9 that was repaired from the corrosion on the sensors. Our lab technician in Melbourne is a bit of a whiz, fully trained by obviously the guys with the long beards and the screwdrivers in Germany. He's I mean, I'll call him a camera nerd, and he'd love it because he is so into how they all work. You should sit them. He's got manuals like this thick. He loves it. He's brilliant, brilliant guy. Anyway, I had a discarded one, let's just say, because of the corrosion. And he said, look, I need to learn how to fix that. So if you'll take the risk, if I fix it, it'll be working. If it's not, you've not lost anything. I said, go your hardest. Anyway, he fixed it. And so now I have a really good condition M9 with the CCD color that goes with it, and the M9, the M8, the 18 mil sits on that. But I would be good looking for a fourth lens of my list, which is probably going to be a Summicron M lens to go with it. Probably a 35 or a 50. I haven't decided yet. Probably a vintage one. Yeah. Probably look for something from the 70s or 80s, not a new one. So we'll see. We'll see. But that would partner very nicely with the M9, because very hard to frame the 18 mil on the M9, of course.
To throw one into the ring on that, I always think 50 mil is cheating and a bit too easy somehow. Like there's a bit too much compression and kind of separation. I'm a 35 shooter myself.
Okay, fighting words.
Yeah, well, yeah. So you know, because I came up with a 35 mil f/2.8. So for me, that's kind of what the world looks like. But I think on your M9, a 35 Summicron V4, that's a lovely. Keep
That'd
it nice
do.
And compact. You know.
Or you could buy a Q343 and have the best of both worlds.
Well, yes.
It's a great camera. It's brilliant. I did all the explainer videos for Leica on the Q3 and the Q343, and it's a really nice bit of kit.
A friend of the show selling her Q2, and I'm photographing a friend's wedding later this year, and I have a one camera rule where I only allow myself to have one at a time. But I could give myself the excuse that, like, well, I will need a second body for a wedding, and it does macro.
You kind of do.
Do the close-ups of the rings and things like that, as well as the establishing.
It is a beautiful, beautiful camera. Really is. Especially the 43. The Q3 I love. I've got one in my bag. I use it a lot. I have a few cameras lying around the office which are not so much long-term loans, but they're kind of forgotten about. They get inquired about in stock takes, and they go, yeah, I've got it. Nobody actually gets around to asking you back, mostly because they're not on sale anymore. So they're not really worth it. They're useful to me because I do technical support within Leica, especially for staff. So it's very useful to have obsolete cameras lying around. So there's a bit of a nod and a wink going on here. So I've got a Q3, which I will have to give back sooner or later. But right now it's very handy, and I do use that quite a bit. I had to give back the Q343, unfortunately, because that was a current item, and we only have so many demo models available. So it got prized out of my cold, dead fingers.
Well, I'm very lucky at the moment. I've got a loaner M11 sat next to me because my M11 developed a fault, and I went into London, and I'm going to the event, the centenary event in June in Vetzlar.
Okay, oh, good.
And I will say this on the podcast, I'm a bit embarrassed. I threw names around like confetti, Nick. I'm going to this thing. I might get to sit down with, you know, Peter Carver and be like, I need my camera with me. And they were great, and they lent me an M11. So mine is probably in Germany, actually. If the timing works out, I may get to pick it up while I'm there and hand them back
the
loaner.
That'd
and
be good.
Pick up mine, which would be quite nice. I'll save them the postage. There we go.
If you see Peter, say hi from me.
Yeah, well, I'm really excited to try and sit down with some folks. So it should be a bit of a good bash.
If you can get to talk to Stefan Daniels, that'd be really good, because he's a really affable guy. He's a bit hard to get at, but he's very, very good at speaking, you know, like this. Really, he's a lovely guy. They're all great, actually. It's actually a remarkable company. I mean, I don't just say that because I'm quite I'm involved with them, but they have the most ludicrously high retention of staff. Mm. It's like 99.9% or something. I mean, there's guys there that have been there 50 years.
Yeah.
You join the company, they train you, you work the right way, and they'll treat you well, you treat them well, and that's it. You're good for life. That's like our technician, Andy, in Melbourne. He's got a job for life if he wants it. It's also quite a flat structure, so you don't really have a massive depth of management. It's only one or two steps to the senior guys.
Yeah.
So it's really great company to work with.
Yeah, they've been lovely to interact with as a person making things, because I've found talking to some camera brands can be quite hard, and like some have come back to me and just said, yeah, we can't really think of anything. We don't really know. And it's like, whereas. Yeah, yeah. Leica were fantastic. I had Stefan on the show fairly early on, really.
Oh, you did? Oh,
yeah,
wonderful.
He's great. Wonderful. And he was on...
Yes, he is. Right.
Mm. He'd been in Scotland. It turned out he'd been on holiday to Scotland with his
right.
Q3.
There you go.
like half an hour away from where I live. And it was really funny.
Right.
It was a lovely chat. And I kick myself still over that one, although hopefully I'll catch him when I'm in Germany again. But I kick myself because I emailed, and obviously he's a busy guy. He's got a lot going on. Mm. And yeah. I emailed about his lens choices and didn't hear anything back, so I didn't push it. I just had the conversation with him because I was excited to talk to him anyway. And then at the end of the episode, if you go back and listen to it, he goes, "What don't you want to know about my lenses?" And I was like, and I think what I realized as well, it was a good learning. Some folks in companies as well, if you get to talk to them, no one ever asks them what they like. They talk about the brand, and they talk about the company, and they talk about whatever they're just about to launch, but no one ever asks them what they like shooting with. And so it was an important lesson to me to remember to be like, you know, to nudge people a bit on the concept for the show, because they might not get asked very often. And actually, it was nice to hear like what he liked shooting and what he enjoyed, and his choices were good. Mm. Yeah.
Mm. Mm. A lot of them are quite passionate about their photography. I mean, obviously, Dr. Kaufman is very passionate about the brand.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, he's the man as far as we're concerned. He single-handedly rescued the company.
I was going to say,
but they all
place.
Are on some level. Yeah, there's he'd be a good one to get on your podcast.
I've put him on the
good
list.
Luck.
They sent me a list of people that, you know, like, here are people you could ask to talk to. And I replied immediately, and he was on my list.
Yes.
Fingers crossed. It'd be nice.
I've never met him. I've only been there. I've never been introduced. I've been in the group sort of thing, but no one's ever introduced me. He's a busy guy too. But everybody else pretty much I've met, which is great. So, I'm very lucky to work for them. I think it's great.
I do get teased occasionally for being a Leica and Polaroid podcast. But the thing is, the Leica folks say yes. You know, like they're interested. Mm-hmm. And you often find, a bit like you with your M9, where you're collecting these things a little bit, and you're like, I'm going to put these together as a set. You know, these work well together. They were kind of, they're of a time. And so I think just that excitement, that enthusiasm comes through.
There's three markets. There's the fashion market with your Hello Kitty versions. There's your collector's market. And then there's people like you and me who use the cameras. I don't think anybody else can actually say that about their products. I mean, again, nobody buys a Canon to go with their Bentley. Really. Yeah, people do. I think early in the piece, somebody sent in their M camera to have it reskinned in a swatch of leather from somebody's Bentley, so it matched the hide of the seats. That's the sort of people you get.
Yes, very nice.
I love that.
Yeah. I think the thing I really enjoy is seeing folks get excited about the kit that they're using and about the images they're making. And it's always nice to remember that these things are tools to be used. They're not like so many. I've got so many friends who do have quite nice cameras, but they just sort of leave them on a shelf, and they don't pull them down enough. And that's the other thing about this. I've had a couple of listeners contact me to say that listening to the show got them to pick up a camera again, and they hadn't done for a while.
That's nice. Leica, as you probably know, have moved into the watch world, and there is an analogy with your high end watches, because at the end of the day, you said it's a tool. Well, there's many tools which will do that just as well, which will cost you $20,
true,
as opposed to $20,000 or more. So there is a pleasure in owning things that you know are beautifully made. And you're going to Wetzlar, you said, for the 100th.
Yes.
Right. Are you booked in for the museum tour?
Yes. Yes.
Good. And what about the archive?
I put both down. I was like, museum and archive,
because that will give you a perspective on, and the factory, of course, that will give you a perspective on the attention to detail I have a story from Stefan Daniel, actually, which I would like to share if it's of use. Was I have I've also got a few R series lenses, and I've got a 90mm Elmerit R, which is a 90mm f/2.8, which is 1965. It's almost as old as me. And just to see what happened, I put it onto an M11 last year, just to see how it stacked up. Now, to be fair, wide open, it's not perfect. F5.6, F4 to 5.6, 60 megapixels of resolution, without a shadow of a doubt. It's epically good. I did some AO prints off it. Oh, wow. So I was in Germany, and I was talking to Stefan Daniel at a function, and I said, so 1965, the best film was probably Kodachrome 25 to 64. I'm not sure my dates with those films. You're probably looking at 8 to 10 megapixels of data capture.
Yeah.
Maybe 12, let's say, not 60. So I said, why would you build a lens that's so way over-engineered, like triple the resolution that it needed to be at the time? You know, why would any? Well, guess what he said.
I mean, the challenge, because we can.
Well, because we could.
Amazing.
That was literally his answer, and I love that.
Yeah.
And I tell people this story a lot, especially when I'm talking to customers, and they love that. We will do it the best we possibly can, given the technology that's available to us, and we won't scrimp on things and build to a price. So my 60-year-old lens with a little bit of help, with just a little bit of aperture change, will still resolve 60 megapixels, which I find astonishing. It's brilliant. I've got a 180 Elmerit R as well, which is the same. I've got a 50mm Summicron R, which I use for video, which is the same. They're a bit more recent, the 1980s, and I bought them because of the manual focusing.
Yeah,
because the helicoid focusing feels so perfect.
Yeah.
And for video focus pulls, it's really important. You can't do that with an autofocus lens. It just doesn't feel right.
Yeah.
That's why everyone's buying up vintage lenses and having them rehoused in cinema housings. So they've got that beautiful helicoid motion. A lot of people don't realize that, but it's absolutely true. And I can pull focus with a manual lens in video better than the autofocus, because it will never track and miss. It will never lose and then track to infinity and back. If I lose focus a bit and pick it up again, nobody cares. So that's why, you know, people who make videos generally use, you know, manual focus lenses if they're serious. I mean, I'd love to be able to trust autofocus, but even now, I don't know what happens if it, you know, do a long take and suddenly the focus just misses.
It shifted to their nose partway through. You can't get them to tell that story again.
Exactly.
It's why I've shot with an M now for nearly 3 years, and I'm mindful that I wouldn't be super comfortable going back to just pure autofocus necessarily anymore, because even on the subject of adapted lenses, I've got a NovaFlex 560 and 400 combo, arm mount, which is insane. And I love using that. The trigger for focusing is hilarious. It's like shooting a gun. And that adapted onto my M, incredible shots of birds in the garden.
That's remarkable.
And things
That's
cool. It's really cool. I picked it up for a song at Christmas. I think the company who was selling it were like, we'll even throw in free next day. And I was like, you really want a shot of this, don't you? Like, they'd knocked 800 quid off it. And they were just like,
I remember
like,
those.
Go. Really, really cool. Yeah. But it's that same experience of like, even at high speeds, I don't know that I want to entirely trust what I'm trying to make to a processor somewhere that's trying to work out using combinations of whatever that, you know, like, it's very clever that it can track eyes and track faces and all the rest of it. But as you say,
up until recently, what I just said, I will stand by, but things do progress.
Yeah.
And again, bit of a sales plug here. Why not? The current model SL3S, that is now magic.
Right.
There was a massive jump in ability because the SL3 is 60 megapixels. It's got way too much information to process. You can't really have high resolution and super fast autofocus because of the amount of progressing that needs to be done. 24 megapixel sensor, hold a whole ball game. It really does work on the eyes. I've tried to fool it by ducking and diving.
Yeah.
It really is the first camera that I probably will start to trust. Okay. And I don't say that lightly, but it really does work well. It's remarkable.
Mm. Yeah. Well, last thing on adapted lenses. Do you ever use your 18? Because your website mentioned you use a CL quite often, like a CL, which I love.
Yeah,
I've
still
camera.
Got that. Yeah, yeah. I don't use it on the CL because it simply replaces the 18 mil that I've got for the CL because it's the same focal length.
Yeah.
So there's no benefit. Right. But I do use it on the SL3. Adapted to the SL3. Yes. So I do it a lot for starscapes and long night exposures and things like that where you want really wide. It's also for the 14 to 24, you can't really put a filter on the front.
Yeah.
And the 24 to 90 is not quite wide enough sometimes, which that's obviously easy to put a filter on. So the 18, I've got a sort of bodgy arrangement where I basically blue tack a filter onto the front of the lens hood. Yeah. It's very clumsy, but it works. And that's my sort of go-to night shot lens. And it's got very little internal reflection, and you don't get that double imaging sometimes you get with some lenses. So it's good for that.
Well, Nick, this has been brilliant. Thank you so much for taking some time to have a chat to me, evening your time. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
If people want to find a bit more Nick or find some of your videos about photography online, where can they find a bit more?
Best place to look these days is on the Australian Leica YouTube channel. So it's Leica Camera Australia is the name of the division. So if you search in YouTube for Leica Camera Australia, you should find our YouTube channel, which is what I administer. And there's a whole bunch of stuff which isn't necessarily Leica oriented. There's a whole 8-part series about photography in general, plus other things, which it's quite a lot to look at. So if you want to see more about what I've been doing the last few years, it's all there. I don't generally do much in social media directly these days. It's pretty much all done through the Leica brand.
Your videos made me brave enough to clean my own sensor. So that was good. I've got a little sticky stick. And
excellent, good. It has good. Never go anywhere with that one.
No. Cool. All right, mate. Well, thank you so much for that. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for inviting me on your show.
Yeah, no problem. All
right, can I call it a show? The podcast?
Yeah, it's a show. Okay. I call it the show. It's the show in the house.
So. Well, there you go.
Cool.
Well, all the best and have a great time in Germany. It's a really cool place to visit and you will enjoy it immensely. I guarantee it.
Yes, brilliant. All right, mate. Thanks so much.
All right. No worries. Bye-bye.
Bye. A huge thank you to Nick there for being on the show. That was a great conversation. And he took time out. He was very busy and it was late in the evening for him. So really, really glad I got to sit down and have a chat with him. Shame he won't be in Wetzlar in June. That'd be really good. If you enjoyed that, don't forget that you can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Amazon Music, all those places. Leave us a comment, leave a review, tell a friend. That would be really good. You can also sign up to the midweek newsletter that goes out every Wednesday, and that's available at ianfarrell.com/sign-up. There is a link to it in the show notes. Right, that'll do it. I'm going to go and try and find an 18mm lens for a reasonable price. And I'll see you next time. Have a good week.